This is Phyllis Marie Jensen, November 13th, 2015, a talk entitled Artist Emily Carr and the Spirit of the Land, a Jungian Portrait.
Dream? A voiceover? You know, where you have a dream and then all of a sudden you have this voice that says blah, 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 blah. Nobody's experienced that? You've had it. Okay. Somebody else had it? Okay. And you've had it, right? Okay. When I was in Zurich, I had a voiceover in a dream that said, do your thesis on Emily. And I thought, well, there's no psychoanalytic portrait. But I was sort of like, I don't know about that. She's a bit weird, crazy, and I don't want to know if I want to have my name identified with her. She's a bit weird. But Jung says when you have a voiceover in a dream, you have to pay attention to it because your psyche's trying to get your attention. But you have to be able to determine whether or not it's the self speaking or is it a complex. Because, you know, if it's complex speaking, you're in great doo-doo. But if it's the self-speaking, you need to listen to it. So what I did is, being a rational researcher, I reread all of Emily Carr's books, and I thought, boy, she's got a real sense of humor. This is really great. And I read the curators, and they're really very positive about her. And then I read her biographers, and I found out that her biographers had maligned her. They had taken a Freudian perspective. None of them were psychologists. And, you know, if you take a Freudian perspective, you then have to find the data to fit the diagnoses. Okay? And so what I've done here in my book is look at Emily Carr with fresh eyes from a Jungian psychoanalytic perspective as an artist. And so tonight I'm going to talk to you about the kinds of things that I've learned. So it's not just me doing Emily Carr a favor by giving a new portrait of her, but in fact, it's really stimulated the work that I'm doing right now. And I'll tell you about it as we go along. So tonight I'm going to tell you about Emily Carr and the Spirit of the Land. But one thing first is that my parents came from Denmark, and they gave me the name Phyllis as my Canadian name. And I hated it because it's too feminine for me. And then I found out that it means a green leaf. And I thought, yeah. They did it inadvertently. So that's one of the reasons why I have the green leaves there. So before we start, a few acknowledgments. I'm going to show you a lot of paintings and art of Emily Carr's. These art galleries and archives have permitted me to use this. And I've put two pictures of her here because I remember talking with one of the Ottawa curators, and she was really quite upset that people always show pictures of Emily Carr when she's young and beautiful. And they said she was just a girl. She'd done nothing at that time. And I thought, but it was still her, you know? And so I like to think that this is her precocious self, and she's looking forward. And it's her beautiful physical self, but I think that the elder picture is her beautiful inner self. So first of all, for those people who don't know Emily Carr, she was born in 1871. I did my thesis on Emily Carr, and one of Murray Stein, who was one of my advisors, said, oh, that was 4 years before Jung. So everything was like in relationship to Jung. She's sometimes called Canada's Van Gogh, and she actually was doing her very spiritual pictures before she'd ever seen Van Gogh's work. And when people sort of accused her of, you know, stealing his ideas, she said, oh, poor Van Gogh. She's considered the mother of modern art in Canada. She was educated in San Francisco, London, Paris, and many art colonies in France. She considered herself a post-impressionist, and she documented First Nation art, and then she moved towards spirited paintings of the land, forest, sea, and sky. So tonight's talk, first of all, we're going to look a little bit at the family background, because you can't really understand a person unless you understand the milieu in which they grew up. And Jung talks about how the family milieu is more important in the development of a child than anything that the parents say. And then we'll look a little bit at her education and travels. Then we're going to look at the archetype of land. This is what working on her material and her life has brought to me, and I think the reason why I had this voiceover that said, do your thesis on Emily Carr, it was so that I could get in touch with the archetype of land. And 2 years ago at the International Association of Analytic Psychology, I did my maiden speech on the migration complex. So I'm introducing it to the discipline. And we'll talk a little bit about that tonight. So that's another gift that Emily Carr has given me. So we'll talk about the difference between the migration complex and the cultural complex, which is now known a little bit more. We'll look at her creative challenges and her spiritual quest. Now, this picture here is a drawing that she did of the old barn studio when she came back to Victoria. After being in England, she needed a studio because her sisters they set up the YWCA, and she said there were all these missionaries praying on all the chairs, and there was no room for her and the kids to do the art. So her eldest sister permitted her to fix up the upper floor at the barn as a studio where she taught her children. And I always think that if I was a kid, I'd love to go there, because look at it. You're going through this gate and up these stairs, and there's cows below, and you know, it's a real kid place. So first, her father. His name is Richard Carr, and he was born in England in 1818. And we don't know much about his family background. He was somewhat educated for that time because he could read and write and do math, and he kept a diary, so we know quite a bit about him from his perspective. And before he was 18, he had traveled on the continent. He'd gone to the major northern European cities. So the family must have had a little bit of money. But he was the youngest of 13 children. So if you got 13 kids and his father was a merchant, you're not going to be able to divide the pie, right? So when he was 18, he left and as a ship hand, and he worked for 12 years, mostly shipping out of New Orleans, but he went all the way from Cuba to Quebec and all around. And he actually spent a whole winter with First Nation people ice fishing in the Great Lakes. And he had great respect for the First Nation people. And in some ways, he thought that they were better than white people. they were more true and more honest. He then studied a kind of photography that they did at that time. It's a silver mirror photography. And he did this for 3 years in South America. He had a horse and a dog. And he went around doing this. And he was in Ecuador when he heard about the California gold rush, and he rushed up there. He staked a claim and mined it for 2 years and made a small fortune, sufficient to open an outfitting store. And we know from studies of the gold rush that the people who made the most money had the stores. Kevin's nodding. Yes, yes. Okay. So he ended up with three outfitting stores and with a couple other colleagues. He was age 37. He was now a millionaire. I tried to do an equivalence of what the amount of money he had at that time with now, and it goes like anywhere from $7 to $67 million. So he was fairly wealthy at the time. And he married and had two children in San Francisco. And he wasn't very happy in San Francisco, and he decided to return to the UK. And we'll talk a little bit about this later, about the migration complex. It's called the wound of return. And at age 43, he and his wife and two children, emigrated to Victoria. It was a British colony at the time. Britain had bought it back from Rupert's Land, which had been a gift to the Hudson Bay Company. And he set up a harborfront wholesale business in Victoria, and he fathered in all 5 daughters and 4 sons. He died in 1888 at the age of 70 in Canada. Mom, Emily Saunders, was born in 1836 in England in a small village, Oxfordshire Village. Shirley was telling me they spent some time in the Cotswolds this couple. When was it? I can't see it. And so she was born in one of those Oxfordshire villages. And she was in San Francisco. Nobody quite knows why. They think maybe she was a governess. She was a lady's companion. Because, you know, women couldn't do anything on their own. So if you wanted to go out shopping, you had to have somebody go with you. It was just considered inappropriate to do anything on your own. She was introduced to Richard Carr, and he went, he's 37, he's wealthy, here's a woman from his homeland, and so he marries her. But in order to marry, they returned to England. Now, at that time, to get to the West Coast, you had to go around the Cape, the Horn, he had done this a couple of times. But he and Emily went to Panama, and then they did a mule train across the isthmus to Cologne, and then boarded a ship to Southampton via Colombia. So it took them 6 months to do this voyage home to get married. But it's very interesting that very few people who came here ever got back. And so they went back to celebrate this, the marriage and the happiness with the families. And he could do that, of course, because he was very wealthy. She was a mother of 9. 6 of them survived, but she was a TB invalid most of her adult life. Now, I've been doing a bit of reading on Emerson. Of course, he is one of your great philosophers, and he talks about how in the 1800s that Boston, 50% of the people in Boston had TB. It was endemic. And so it's not unusual that she had TB. She died in 1886, the age of 50, in Canada. Emily Carr had 5 sisters. I wish I had a pointer, but the one on the left is Dee Dee, or Edith, who is her nemesis. She was the eldest. And then next to her is Tally, or Clara. She's the only one that married. And some biographers have accused Emily Carr's father of not permitting the girls to marry, but he died before these younger 3 were of marriageable age. So I'm arguing you can't blame him that they didn't marry. But over there we have Lizzie, who was a bit of a trial for Emily, and Alice sitting in front of her, who was her favorite sister. I'm not quite sure why, but they shared a room. And then Emily. Of the 5, Emily was the youngest, the prettiest, and her father's favorite. She tried all of her life to have an authentic relationship with them, and they were unrelentingly cruel, critical, rejecting, and non-supportive. And I think that envy and jealousy played a large role, because if you're sort of a funny-looking hag and you got this beautiful sister, well, yeah, you better be envious. Eh? Okay, she had 4 brothers. William and John were born in England when they had gone back, and they died within weeks. So the mom had TB. So we know that women with tuberculosis actually can't carry, the babies are weak and they don't survive. Then she had Thomas, who was born, you know, sometime after, closely after the arrival in Victoria, but he lived only 5 months. So there's a lot of grief in this family. And I think if we're going to try and understand the older sisters and maybe their negative attitudes, we have to look at how the family was grieving. Then Richard, or Dick, named after the father, who was 4 years younger than Emily, was very close to her, but he was never, ever well, and he died of TB when he was 22. Look a little bit here at the importance of the father. In Jung's view, the unconscious atmosphere of the family milieu is more influential than the conscious pedagogical behavior of the parents. Von Franz talks about this in Archetypal Dimensions of the Psyche. And then she goes on to say, when a daughter has a close positive relationship to her father, this gives her an active spirituality and an aliveness of the mind with mental and spiritual interests. And Jung says women with a strong father relation do not just do things to please men, rather they do these things on their own. And Emily Carr's whole life is evidence of doing things on her own for her own reasons. The importance of the mother. We, of course, have to look at attachment theory here, because physical and emotional attachment to mother is instinctual and imperative for survival. Attachment also plays a role in personality development, and secure attachment engenders trust and freedom to develop a sense of self and relationship to others. It enables independence, interdependence, self-expression, and ability to explore and to play, and play is the work of children. One of the things I'm arguing in my book is that because her mother was an invalid and her brother was not born till 4 years after she was, that she had extended time with her mother as well as her father, and with her mother being an invalid, she probably only had to take care of the infant. So I think that Emily had a much closer connection to her mother because the mother was ill. Sometimes people think an ill mother doesn't have as much close connection, but if she's got other people to help her, then the possibility is there. But it's hard to explain why Emily felt so secure and so able to do her own thing in a time when women weren't allowed to be people. In fact, they weren't people. In Canada, women were not persons under the law until 1928. So most of her life, she was not a person. Emily and attachment. There's evidence of secure attachment. She trusted others, she explored, she played, she was happy alone, yet she was friendly and she bonded easily. She valued herself, she cherished her relationships with others. She was relatively objective and autonomous in relationships, and she could express her own wishes and feelings and could say no. You see, in a Victorian time, a woman could not say no. So the idea that people have been putting forward about her as this sort of bitch, witch, crazy kook lady is basically she was more authentic than anybody else around, and they couldn't bear it. People don't like the mirror of an authentic person. It's hard to say that, but it's true. If somebody is really together, it really creates envy. The sister Didi, now we can look at her and think she was a real bitch witch and asshole and all that kind of stuff. She was 15 years older than Emily, and she became one of a co-guardian when the parents died. Her desire to be a missionary was thwarted by Victorian demands to be a self-sacrificing, dutiful daughter. This is what women were supposed to be. And she was physically and emotionally abusive towards Emily. She was actually quite good in painting. She did China painting. Women were allowed to do China painting, and she used to win awards at the local fair for her painting on China. And her actions triggered Emily's justice complex, which forced her to learn to umweg physically and psychologically. Anybody know Swiss Deutsch here? Umweg means to go the other way. So if you have a really difficult person who's putting up barriers, but she's not your authentic. Emily didn't see her as being authentic. She saw her as a sister, and she was really pissed off when Didi would try to assert her authority and prevent things. So this is the justice complex. But what it did, and it was important for her, is it made her learn how to do things differently. She went, okay, she's not letting me do this. What can I do, right? Because she wouldn't let Emily go away to art school. So Emily tried many, many ways to have the woman change her mind, and she didn't do anything. So she marched down to the lawyer who was the co-guardian and said, I want to go to art school. And he let her. So that's an example of umweg. If you don't have that growing up, if everything's eased for you, then you never learn how to problem solve. well, I shouldn't say you never learn, but it's more difficult. But if you're up against a barrier like this, which you see as unjust or unjust, you're going to learn how to unvig. Now, this is a painting that Emily did in 1890 before she went to art school. And she went, she wanted to go to England because she had some teachers who were from France, and they said, oh, you have to go to France, you have to go to France. But I think she compromised, and she agreed to go to San Francisco instead of pushing for England. That's the other thing, is that she had to learn in her unbegging that you don't always get what you want. And she says, this is from her book, Growing Pains, which is her autobiography, sketching outdoors was a fluid process, awaiting invitation from the spirit of the subject to come meet me halfway. These space things asked to be felt with one's whole self. But after 3 years in San Francisco studying art, she describes her art as humdrum, unemotional, objects honestly portrayed, nothing more. And she says she had not considered what was underneath the surfaces nor the inside of myself. And we have very, very little art of hers from this period. She then taught art in that studio barn, and she apparently kept her money in an old shoe that she hung off the rafters. She must have had more than one because she saved quite a bit of money. And she went to the Westminster School of Art in London. Now, she really wanted to go to France, but she had pronunciation dyslexia, and she was unable to work with foreign words, so she was afraid to go there. So she compromised again and went to the Westminster School of Art. She arrived with her guitar and her easel. She was very musical, and she took music lessons, guitar lessons, when she was in San Francisco. But when she got there, there was a series of disappointments. First of all, she was told that her brother Dick had died in California. The school, the Westminster School, was not the new art that she was seeking, that her French art teachers had told her about. And she found that there was a huge contempt for colonials. I lived in England for 3 years. I found that too. When they'd get mad at me, they'd call me a bloody colonial. And I was like, what? But anyway, she found London hot, dirty, and overcrowded. It was summertime, and it can get pretty hot in England in the summer. And she became ill. But she was always a trooper. She settled in. And people have said that she was a prude. But she says about her life drawing classes, I had never been taught to think of our naked bodies as something beautiful, only as something indecent, something to be hidden. Here was nothing but loveliness. So that's not a prude, right? The other thing is that I have almost a whole chapter in my book arguing that she had chronic fatigue at a time before it was diagnosed. And so she was given a diagnosis that fit with the time that's no longer current. In England, Emily survived with music, art, travels, and many, many friends. She also went to the continent and did the galleries. But mostly at 5 o'clock each afternoon, the great organ played, flooding St. Paul's Cathedral with music. She talks about going there all the time. She had a teacher, Talmage, in one of the art colonies, who provided pearls of wisdom which describe her approach to art and life. Where you are happy, you do your best work. And remember, there is sunshine, too, in the shadows. And so she was hospitalized for 18 months in a TB sanatorium. She was very resilient. She emerged from an adversary each time something happened to her. She became philosophical about the opposite contraries of life. When she arrived home, she said, oh, the gladness of my West again. Immense Canada. Oh, her Pacific edge, her Western limit. I blessed my luck, it should be, in being born a Westerner. We're going to slip now a little bit to a bit of theoretical work. This is Emily's sketchbook from when she was a young girl. I love the boat. Archetypes are psychic instincts, universally present and vary over time and culture. They're visible in myths, symbols, rituals, and psychological complexes. And Jung says a direct experience of the archetype is a numinous experience, a fearful and fascinating mystery, an overwhelming, woolly other experience with the power to transform psyche. Has anybody here had a numinous experience? Kim? Yeah? Somebody else there? Yeah? Yep. Quite a few people have had. Sometimes it's a numinous experience that brings people into Jungian work. They're looking for an explanation. I'm arguing land is an archetype. This is a painting that she did of Beacon Hill Park just beyond the her yard. Through spirit experience of space and place, we are imprinted with the land of our origins. Art studies report landscape as the universally preferred subject of paintings, most notably a bluish scene with trees, water, humans, and animals. This is believed to represent the ideal or archetypal survival environment of our primordial ancestors. We have an attachment to land. We have not just an attachment to human beings, but to land. And Wallach, I don't know why he published in the Journal of Management Education, but there it is. You find things where they go. When land is local, bounded, and personal, it becomes a place. And we have experiences in places. We build memories of them and become emotionally attached to them. This is a painting in 1908, pretty early. Here's what Emily Carr says on land. When she went to London, she didn't have to go via the horn. She went on the train because this was after 1867 and the railroad was put in for Canada's Confederation when it became a country. So she was able to take the train. And she said, Canada's vastness took my breath away. The up and down of the Rockies, their tips dangled in cloud, thrilled and were part of me, though I had to steel myself as we glided over trestle bridges of great heights, spanning gorges and ravines with rivers like white ribbon boiling far below and lofty trees looking crouched and squat down there in the bottom of the canyons while we slid over their tops. We squeezed through rocky passes, hid in tunnels, raced roaring rivers, slunk through endless levels of dead, still forest, black, green, and mysterious, layer upon layer of marching trees, climbing trees, trees burned, trees fallen, mirrored millions of trees, and loneliness intertwisted. She's got a very poetic sense, and one of the reasons why I like her books is because it's like she's writing a painting. And when she had several heart attacks and she wasn't able to paint, and she started writing. Well, she started writing way back, but she got into it quite seriously at that time. She decided that it was much easier to write than it was to paint. And I think anybody who's tried both knows that it probably is a bit easier. So Earth has a soul. Jung says, and the spirit of the land lives within us, and our present danger is alienation from nature, a lack of respect for nature, and not honoring nature inside and outside of ourselves. And he advises us to spend time in nature. If you're interested in this work of Jung on nature, Sabini has collected all of his writings on nature. It's quite a nice little volume. One of the reasons why I chose this picture is, are you familiar with the Group of Seven in Canada? Okay, look at the date of this picture. Her work predates that of the Group of Seven. So when she met them, Loren Harris said, you're one of us, right? Because she'd been doing this all along on her own. This is a lamp that Emily Carr made. She was a real craftsperson. It's carved. It's a beaver from a copy of the Totem Poles. People think of her as poor. She was actually a minor heiress who had an apartment house, and she had a cash flow problem. So she did everything she could. She picked berries, she raised dogs, she raised birds, sold them, and she had a kiln in the backyard, and she would fire 500 souvenir objects at a time. They didn't come from China the way they do today. They were done in Emily Carr's backyard. And she was... she did it to survive, okay? So if we look at migration, Her father, who was a seaman, a photographer, a gold miner, and a merchant, he went from England to North America, to South America, to the California Gold Rush, and he lived in California for over 10 years, to England, and then to Victoria. And Emily Carr went from Victoria to San Francisco, to London, and Europe, in France, Vancouver, and Victoria. She lived in Vancouver for about 10 years. One of the reasons why the major, the Emily Carr Trust, which is the major collection of her work, is in Vancouver, is because Victoria didn't have an art gallery at the time that she set up the trust. It was Lorraine Harris, who was one of her executors that of the state that helped her do that. So, if we talk about the Cotswolds, the Oxfordshire villages that Emily's mother and her father grew up in, here's an example. Now, this is a modern picture. It's got TV antennas, it's got electrical wires, and it's got a war memorial. So if you take away those, basically that's where the mother, the kind of environment the mother and father grew up in. And here's what happened when they came to Canada. And Emily says that when her mother came to Victoria, she cried. I can see that. Yeah. Come from that beautiful sort of cottage country and to this. I'll show you a little few pictures from the archives of Victoria. This is the bridge. The water here is where the Empress Hotel now sits. And Emily talks about how people used to throw their garbage in there and then the tide would take it out, but it smelled terribly. And that funny-looking building is called the Birdcages, and that was the first parliament building for the province, and it was made of wood. And that's why they called it the Birdcages. And now, of course, it's very magnificent, and this is where the cruise ships come in. This is the house that Emily Carr's father had designed for his family, which still is there and is a museum, and you can get in and see it, but you can't get upstairs. You got upstairs. I can, but because the people who curate this live upstairs. So let's look a little bit at migration. Migration is a separation from familiar landscapes. It's a loss of valued possessions. There's environmental shifts, often from rural, non-industrial places to urbanized, technological, industrialized places. There's changes in human-animal relationships, encounters with new physical objects, and changes in subjective experiences of time. In Maclean's magazine, which is sort of Canada's national news magazine, they've had a number of stories on the Syrians, first in Finland, who got there, hated it. I don't know if anybody here has been to Finland. Yeah? Okay. Why do you think they hated?
Well, I know most of them migrated in my family to Minnesota because it's so much like it.
Okay. And just last week there was an article about the Syrians in northern Sweden. Sweden said, yes, you can come, but we need you in the north. So they sent them up north where there isn't much. And the story starts that the Syrian opens the door and there's this film over everything and he thinks that it's chemical warfare. He's never seen frost. And they talk about they don't speak the language. There's no, the library has one book in English. And they have to have a certain level of competency in Swedish before they can get jobs. They're mostly just stranded there in the northern part of Sweden and quite depressed and unhappy. So it'll be interesting to see how many people actually stay. Now, if they solve the problem upstream, maybe I think people will be able to go back. So the migration complex is, there's several different manifestations of it. I'm working on a book called The Psychodynamics of Migration. So you have instant assimilation where the person just embraces the society and never looks back. You have repudiation and denial. You see, it depends upon, if you have a family coming, it depends upon who decides to come. Like, for instance, if Richard Carr decided to come, but his wife wanted to stay in England and his daughters wanted to stay in England, or maybe his daughters wanted to stay in San Francisco, the oldest ones, because they were born there. So you have different motivations for going and different attitudes towards the land. For some people, they sit in repudiation and denial. I did some work with the Kosovo refugees. I lived in Toronto for a long time, and refugees are different than people who migrate with a purpose, because they're, in a sense, being forced out of their land. So you can see how somebody who comes unwillingly, but just for safety and survival, can really be unhappy. They can deny they're there, literally deny they're there, and not like where they are. Another kind of response is called the fantasy of return. I remember a colleague of mine from New Zealand, I asked her about whether or not she was going to go back when she retired, and she said, good God, no. I lost two generations coming here, her parents and her grandparents, and if I go back, I'll lose two generations, my children and my grandchildren. She said, I live in the land of longing. So basically, the land of longing is this fantasy of return. So people are like psychically not present here, and they're just not present. It's different than repudiation and denial, because they're just so positively focused towards the old country. So what happens often with the fantasy of return is something called the wound of return. In Canada, it used to be called the $1,000 immigrant ticket, because that's what it cost a family to go back home. I have a client right now from Iran, and she really gets uptight about Canada, and she's very well educated, and she says, they're so polite. I hate how polite everybody is. And I said, but look, at we're a multicultural country. We have to be careful not to step on people's toes. And of course we're going to be polite, right? But she hates the fact that people are not assertive, not in your face, the way they were in Iran. It's those kinds of things that make people feel discombobulated when they're in a new country. So the wound of return is they go back. Now, Emily Carr's parents and the two eldest sisters living in San Francisco were doing very, very well. He was very wealthy, and but he didn't like it. And he decided that they would go back. So they went back to Devon, and they were there for 2 years. And in his diary, he says, I've changed. In 25 years, I've changed. And he said, it's not the way I thought it was. And I can't stay here anymore. Some people say one of the major problems is that he was it's called status inconsistency. He was a merchant's lad who's now a multimillionaire and a landowner. And I lived in England for a couple of years, and you know, they've got their hierarchy, right? And you don't fit in very easily. My friends, a friend of mine, her sons were, she overheard them talking, and they're going to this spiffy school, and one of the English boys was counseling the son about whether or not he should be friends with Fred. Okay, so Alan is counseling Bob not to be friends with Fred. And the justification he gave was they had to buy their furniture. So if somebody was worthy within his framework, that you inherited your furniture, you didn't buy it. So that's the kind of stuff that they were encountering when they went back to England. They were nouveau riche. They were out of their status, and you know. So I think that's partially what happened with the wound of return. But of course, he was a very energetic man. He's been doing all kinds of things. He was 45, and he's now retired on this little piece of land in Devon. I don't think that it really suited him. So he decided to come to Canada. Well, at that time, he decided to come to the British colony of Vancouver Island. And so they did. And another response to migration is called replication. And we'll look at this a little bit more, because this is basically what Emily Carr's parents did and the community of Victoria did. And some people complain they're still doing it. Psychic union is that you actually have this relationship with the country of origin and you're not there. It's a bit different than repudiation. Repudiation has a negative thing. Denial is like cutting yourself off. But psychic union is just you're not here. You're not present. Repatriation is when you take all of your stuff, all of your accumulated wealth, and you put it back into your country of origin. You don't leave it in the new country. Replication is the most common response to migration. This is a recreation of the homeland in the new land. They live in ethnic communities, eat ethnic food, listen to ethnic music, and associate within the ethnic group. Emily Carr says, they forgot that England, even conservative England, had crept forward since then, but these Western settlers had firmly adhered to their old, outworn methods and seen beloved England as it had been. They held to their old ideals. It's interesting when the Syrians began to leave and Merkel said, welcome them to Germany. And she told the right-wingers, they will not have a parallel society. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in Germany with the number of Syrians there. Will they be permitted to replicate their homeland in the new land? That was one of the little clay pots that Emily Carr made. And Emily Carr, in her Book of Small, this is her child's view of life when she was growing up. She says, Father wanted his place to look exactly like England. As far back as I can remember, Father's place was all made and in order. The house was large and well-built, of Californian redwood, the garden prim and carefully tended. Everything about it was extremely English. It was as though Father had buried a tremendous homesickness in this new soil, and it had rooted and sprung up English. There were hawthorn hedges, primrose banks, and cow pastures with shrubberies. We had an orchard and a great tin-lined apple room, wonderful strawberry beds and raspberry and currant bushes, all from imported English stock, and an Isabella grapevine. We had chickens and cows and a pig, a grand vegetable garden. Almost everything we ate grew on our own place. He planted cowslips and primroses and hawthorn hedges and all the Englishy flowers. He had stiles and meadows and took away all the wild Canadianness and made it as meek and English as he could. So you see, she's very observant and she can see this replication response. It's very interesting that Emily Carr had an epiphany when she was in Alaska. In San Francisco, she identified as English. In England, she realized she was a Canadian. I realized this too. My parents came from Denmark, and I used to call myself a Danish Canadian. And then in Denmark, I realized that I was, as the French say, a Canadian of Danish origin. And it's a huge switch. I don't. You've done that switch too, hey? Yeah. So in England, she realized that she was not English. She was a Canadian. Well, if you're being told you're a bloody colonial, you're not there. But when she saw the totems in Sitka, she realized the First Nation art of the Pacific Northwest was as important as the art of ancient lands. And she believed, and everybody else believed, that it was endangered and about to be disappearing, and she vowed to document it. And so this was an epiphany she had. She said, oh my God, this is important art, right? And this art belongs here, comes from the land. Let's look a little bit at the First Nation people in her life. She says, Father was a wholesale importer of provisions, wines, and cigars. His store was down on War Street amongst the other wholesale places. The part of War Street where Father's store stood had only one side. In front of the store was a great hole where the bank of the shoreline had been dug out to build wharfs and sheds. You could look out over the tip of these to the Songhees Indian Reserve on the opposite side of the harbor. The Indians came across the harbor in their dugout canoes to trade at the store. They squatted on the veranda discussing new-bought goods, or their bare feet pattered up and down the boardwalks of Wharf Street. Here's Victoria. If I had a pointer, I'd show you.
I actually figured out that this is the car house. Mm-hmm. And depending upon who you read, he had 7 to 9 acres, so he had most of this or this, I don't know. And Emily said that when they, there were no houses near them. So this is 15 years after they arrived. And so if you look here, you'll see this is the bridge, right? This is where the Empress Hotel is now. This is where the apartment buildings are. It's all built up. And this is Wharf Street. And so my father's, let's see, a bit too close. This customs house is still there. Mm. So her father's place was about there. And you see, this is where the Songhees reservation, or it wasn't a reservation, this is where their land was, and that's where they were living. There were some living here. This is all rock out crops, so they didn't live there. But there were some here, and there were some here, and there were some along that way. So she lived very close to where the First Nation people. And when she was growing up, 2 out of 5 people were First Nation. So they were in her face all the time. They're part of her life. And the mother actually hired a First Nation woman to do the washing. So her father, if that's one of his places, this is the view he had. This particular picture is a view from the First Nation settlement across to Wharf Street. So you can see how they were very present in her life. But it wasn't until she went up north to Alaska. Her sister had, her favorite sister, had an accident and cut off part of her finger. And so she was said, you know, don't get so upset, let's go on a cruise. And it's a solution for many people. And so they went up to Alaska, and she was amazed because she had never seen their art in situ. She'd never seen it in the villages. She'd never seen it as incorporated into their culture. She'd only seen it as separate. They were very visible in her life. And they were not moved from that place across from Wharf Street until she was 58. So they were still very much part of her life. And she had many First Nation friends, which was considered just absurd, right? So here's a picture of the First Nation groups in the West Coast. And early in the 20th century, Emily Carr had 7 trips up the coast with her dog and herself and her sketch pad. And she visited 42 of the 45 villages that were known at that time of the First Nations people. Tomorrow we're going to talk mostly about the Kakakakwa, who are the people. The reason why we're going to talk about them is because... Franz Boas, the father of anthropology in the U.S., collected his data there. For 30 years, he had a Métis fellow, George Hunt, who collected his data. And so there's a huge archive in Columbia University. They're still working on it. It's the largest collection of ethnography of any tribal people in the whole world. So it's pretty amazing. So we're going to talk about them tomorrow. Here's what Jung says about primitive art. The unconscious, insofar as it's activated in any way by small amounts of energy, is projected upon certain more or less suitable objects. Thus does primitive man dwell in his land, and at the same time the land of his unconscious. Everywhere his unconscious jumps out at him, alive and real. How different is our relationship to the land we dwell in? Feelings totally strange to us accompany the primitive at every step. Who knows what the cry of a bird means to him or the sight of that old tree?
a whole world of feeling is closed to us and is replaced by the pale asceticism. Nevertheless, the world of primitive feeling is not entirely lost to us. It lives on in the unconscious. And tomorrow we're going to look a lot at the mindset of mythology. We're going to differentiate between scientific directed thinking and mythology, as well as learn how to read totems. And we'll work with Jung's idea on primitive art. So Emily Carr, I argue that she really apprenticed in First Nation art, because she went and looked at it and copied it. That sounds like an apprenticeship to me. It taught her to look with fresh eyes at the land of her birth. And in First Nation art, she saw the spirit of the land. And through it, she experienced a greater sense of place and belonging. It motivated and inspired her work and influenced her vision of herself. The migration complex versus the cultural complex. I don't know if you're familiar with Kimball's work on the cultural complex. But the migration complex is about attachment, separation, laws, and adaptation. And the cultural complex is about values, beliefs, and attitudes towards the self and others. And some people confuse migration complex and cultural complex. A cultural complex is the emotional response to a culture and country. It is individual and collective. It's expressed in images, emotions, practices rooted in the cultural unconscious of the group. It seizes the imagination, behavior, and emotions of the collective and can unleash irrational forces in the name of their own logic. Emily's cultural complex developed in response to elitism of the emigre English community. She saw their superior attitudes and prejudice as sham and pretense. She says, "The English rile me, hard, dictatorial, self-satisfied. All the doors of my inner self are shut." H&T is her journal, Hundreds and Thousands. Her cultural complex was multidimensional, linked to her family's migration replication response, an authority complex, and a justice complex. The outer layer of her cultural complex is the intergenerational English-Canadian split. If you look at adaptation or if you look at migration, the first generation, the people who come, have a very different relationship to the new land than the kids that are born there. And so Emily Carr was born there. And so I'm arguing that she was struggling being betwixt and between. So one of the reasons why my psyche said do your thesis on Emily Carr is because I'm one of those second generation kids who struggled betwixt and between two countries. And Emily was really annoyed that the English would have these pictures of these perfectly beautiful little gardens, English gardens, when outside there were like massive cedar trees and brambles and, you know, mountains and rushing waves. And she says, "Dominated by deaf England and English traditions, they are decorating their tombstones while living things clamor to be fed." And in 1927, when her art was recognized, she was 56, as symbolic of Canada, it legitimated and strengthened her identification with her birthland, Canada. The inner layer of her cultural complex was the English First Nations split. As I said, two-thirds were Aboriginal. And her epiphany upon seeing Aboriginal villages and their art and culture made visible her feeling about living on expropriated land. The Australians call it whispering in the heart, an unspoken inner distress about Indigenous people and daily reminders of their second-class status. One of the things that's very interesting about BC is that BC and Vancouver Island were bought back from Rupert's Land, from the Hudson Bay Company, and they became a British colony. And when Canada was moving across the land, it made treaties, well, some people call them trickeries, with the First Nation people. But because BC was British land, they didn't make treaties, because it wasn't part of the Canadian process. It wasn't part of Canada until a confederation. So most of BC is is unceded. They have not treated it. And so many things that happen in Vancouver, they will make acknowledgement the fact that we are on First Nation land, because it's never been, no treaties or formal obligations have been made. And so one of the reasons why there is still a lot of discussion around First Nation rights in BC is because they're still working on some kind of relationship. And people in the environmentalist movement are really hoping that the First Nation people can help with preventing more expropriation of land and taking of the land. So here was Emily Carr. She's alone. She's working on this stuff by herself. She's making all these objects, raising all these dogs, this cash flow problem. She's got no support for her art. And then she's recognized by the Canadian government, in a sense. They realized that if they were going to do something about the problem with the First Nation people, they were going to have to recognize them sort of culturally. And so they set up a show in Ottawa on Western art and First Nation art, and most of it was Emily Carr's stuff. I mean, she was safe, eh? But when she got there, she met Loren Harris, who was one of the founders of the Group of Seven, and he's an expressionist and an impressionist, and they just clicked. He's a pretty wonderful person. I love his art. How many people know Loren Harris's art?
Yeah,
good. Okay, he's pretty amazing. The other person that was really important to her was Mark Toby. He was a Seattle artist, and he's a cubist and abstract expressionist. They had a little bit of toughy stuff between them because he was kind of domineering and insisted that he taught her cubism, and I think he really strengthened her art, but it was, they respected each other, but I have an artist friend who, we get together, we have positive thoughts about each other, but we always end up fighting. There's just something that doesn't work. And so that's how it was with Mark. Mark used to come up and run art classes in her studio. This is Loren Harris's Mount Lefroy. This is a mountain on the Continental Divide, now in Banff National Park. And Emily Carr saw this and she went, oh my God. And this is Mark Toby's sort of, he has more dimensionality. I did a couple of years of fine art and we were trying to look at them, create mass, right? And so he taught her how to create mass. Her drawings were quite flat before that, her paintings were flat. So, you know, if you have a complex can be depotentiated. It can lose its energy. And that's one of the things we're trying to do in analysis is realize what's triggering it, what enables it, and work through it so that it doesn't trigger you and take hold of you anymore. And when that happens, we call it depotentiation. You actually never, ever get rid of it. It's sort of in the background, but it's not driving you nuts or taking over your life. And so when Emily directed her focus away from First Nation art, because Loren Harris and Toby said, you have to stop copying their art. You've got to do something on your own, or otherwise you're not a real artist. Toby was more direct in that way. When she transferred her emotional investment into painting the forest, sea, and sky, her cultural complex lost some of its power. It depotentiated, and new dimensions emerged in her art and her person. And these two paintings, Doris Shadbolt is one of her major curators. She's now gone, but she said these are her transition paintings. If you look at the Indian church, she's still doing First Nation stuff because this is a First Nation church, but it's a Christianized religious thing. So it's transitional for the First Nation people, but the forest is dominating it. If you look at Gray, and Loren Harris loved that painting so much that he bought it. And he used to send it around to all kinds of shows and it won prizes. And Doris Shadbolt said this is Emily Carr's best painting from a painter's point of view. And this is one of them that Toby takes credit for. But if you look at the way the light sits in it, she's really trying to work with Harris's light. There's an inner light in that painting. Now, it's privately owned, but it's sort of on loan to the Vancouver Art Gallery, so I've been able to see it in person. And it's bigger than I thought it was. I'd only seen it in pictures before. This is not a great reproduction of it because it's more gray. This has too much brownie red in it, but it's quite beautiful. It's stark. It's quite startling.
How big is it?
It's quite big, and so is Indian Church. Quite big. Indian Church is in the Art Gallery of Ontario in Toronto. They have a new. They redid their gallery, and they have a beautiful new wing on the front of it, where the first the Group of Seven is. So, if you go to Toronto, make sure you go see the Art Gallery. Her new attitude did not translate immediately into art. She says, "I sat before the woods and was scared, lost, frustrated. It was not handling of paint, but handling of thoughts which overwhelmed me." She said, "I went into the woods, half lost, learning a new language or different dialect. Slowly I began to put feeble scratchings and smudges of paint onto my paper, returning home disheartened, wondering, waiting for the woods to say something to me personally." I love this painting. "Finding the subject was a problem. She said, I sat before it for some time before I touched a brush, feeling my way into it, asking myself these questions. What attracted you to this particular subject? Why do you want to paint it? What's its core, the thing you're trying to express? After finding it, she wrote down her thoughts, presenting essentials only, discarding everything of minor importance. This, saying in words as well as color and form, gave me double approach." So she was already working on her writing by trying to understand what she was trying to express in painting. I think this is one of the reasons why her writing is so powerful. And she had a terrible time finding a publisher. But you know what? Her books have never been out of print since 1940. So this painting called Scorn Dis Timber, Beloved of the Sky, is actually being used by the environmentalist movement. Some of her biographers say that this is a self-portrait, that she was, I think they're just, what do you call it? I won't say that, it's nasty, but I don't agree with them. She was mad that people saw it as a painting of a tree because she said it was a painting of the sky, and then she said, "I guess I wasn't clear about that." She had a dream. She records quite a few of her dreams. "I saw a wooded hillside, an ordinary slope, such as one might see along any western roadside, tree-covered, normal, no particular pattern or design to catch an artist's eye or seeking subject matter. But in my dream, that hillside suddenly lived, weighted with sap, burning in every leaf." I think I made a mistake there. "Every scrap of it vital. Woods that had always meant so much to me from that moment meant just so much more." And so you see, she's got all of this dynamic energy. This is why people call her Canada's Van Gogh. But she did this before he was doing it, or at the same time he was doing it. This is another one of my favorite paintings. And this is another dream. She said, "Last night I dreamt that I came face to face with a picture I'd done and forgotten. A forest done in simple movement, just forms of trees moving in space. It is the third time I've seen pictures in my dreams, a glint of what I'm striving to attain." And she concretized the dream by sitting in the forest with an open mind before painting. She says, "I do not say to myself, I will do thus and so or so. I leave myself open to lead, doing just what I see to do at the moment, neither planning or knowing, but quietly waiting for God and my soul." And I think that's one of the really important things about her art, is that she was open and she was patient. But she struggled. This is a particular painting she struggled with for 6 weeks. And if you read her diary, she's getting madder and madder at it. So often when she found it, it remained a struggle. You saw about Leifroy, and she wasn't going to do that. But she wanted to she wasn't as used to mountains as people live in interior BC, and she found them overwhelming and almost oppressive, and she's trying to get that sense in this painting. And she worked on this for 6 weeks, and then she kept going, oh, it's dead, I can't do it. And my inner self said, start again and profit by our experience. This is the vague kind of part of her personality. Oh, if I could only make her throb into life, a living, moving mass of splendor, splendid power and volume. And once again emerged her persistence and resilience and effort rewarded, she began to see her struggle as the working out of a method, and her joy returned. And she actually gave the painting away, and she said, I was so happy when it went out the door. It was like, I struggle with it. So and then she said, after this, she said, I'm painting my own vision now, thinking of no one else's approach, trying to express my own reactions. This was important because in Harris's painting, Emily Carr recognized a holiness that she attributed to theosophy, because he was a theosophist. She says, I did not want to copy his work, but I wanted to look out of the same window onto life and nature, to get beyond the surface as he did. Believing theosophy could also infuse her paintings with holiness, she began reading. She read Opensky and all the big ones, eh? She liked the idea of the earth soul, but she found theosophy too intellectual, too dry. She said she could not think her way through it. Well, thinking was her inferior function, and that's why she really struggled with it. I argued that she was a feeling sensate. She also got caught in transcendentalism. She read Henry David Thoreau's Walden, where he says, we need the tonic of wildness. We can never have enough of nature. She carried Walt Whitman's poetry and often quoted from Song of Myself, where he says, I stand in my own place with my own day before me. There is no God any more divine than yourself. She accepted transcendentalism's basic tenet, being is important, and the necessity of direct experience and immediate intuitive knowledge of spiritual reality. But after a series of church services by visiting East Indian Christian with roots in pantheistic Hinduism, she says she suddenly experienced the whole being of Christ in him and his teachings, epitomizing Christ's love represented in the gospel, and she decided to let go of the philosophers and to embrace Christ. So I'm arguing that she had developed a pagan Christianity. Carr fused pantheistic principles with her Christian faith. She combined a pagan god of nature with a Christian god of love. For her, art was a sacred practice. She meditated in the forest until the subject expressing God in nature spoke to her. And then while singing hymns of praise, she painted. She expressed her own individual symbol of God as nature. And she envisioned ensoulment of the earth, or as Hillman says, intimate conversations with matter and recognition of the anima mundi. We're almost finished. It was to Mother Earth that Emily bonded most strongly, describing herself as a child of nature. I was reared an earthly child, she says. And it was to nature that she turned when dealing with difficult emotions, by tramping uphill or delving into the forest or by exploring the beach with her dogs. In her journal, after relating unpleasant encounters, she soothes herself by remembering nature. She says, regard the warm red earth, a continuous process of life, eternally changing, expanding round and round. See God in it all. Enter into the life of the trees, the God in you responding to the God in them. I am all time. I am heaven. I am earth. I am all in all. Dear Mother Earth, I think I've always specially belonged to you. I love the look of you and the smell of you and the feel of you. I love this painting. This is one of my favorites. So, Emily Carr wrote when she had her heart attacks, and it was Ira Dilworth, a former university professor and a Canadian Broadcasting Company director, who edited her stories and arranged for Kiewit to be read on the radio. Some people say that this was the love of her life. She opened up to him. There's a whole book of correspondence with him, her letters to him. She opened up to him like she'd never opened up to anybody else. And she talks about how he was quite a bit younger than her, that she could love him just openly, you know, like a mother loves a son or somebody loves somebody else. But she really opened up to him. And of death, she said, I should like, when I'm through with this body and my spirit released, to fly up to those wonderful mountain passes and ravines and feed on the silence and wonder. Her ecstatic belief of the sacred earth represents a deep potentiation of her spiritual complex and the emergence of a personal, natural religion with an animistic reciprocity between being a woman as a rock, a tree, and an animal as equal entities. The last dream she recorded. Somewhere there is a beautiful place. I went there again last night in my dreams. I've been there many, many times. It is extremely Canadian, typically Vancouver Island. On the east, it is bounded by a deep bay with a beach with driftwood. Other nights have been to the other side of this place, so I know what is up beyond the arbutus trees. Something seems to keep you out. I don't know what. I wonder where this place is, what it belongs to, why I go there and love it, and am content for the present anyway to keep out. And this is one of her paintings. I think this is the painting of her dream, right? And she was sitting on the beach one day with her dogs, and she said, am I a one-person kind of artist? Why don't I paint the sea? And so she did a whole series of sea paintings. There you are.
So how are people doing?
Fine. Yep.
Would you like to take a break?
Yeah.
Take about a 10-minute break to come back around 8:30.
And she came up to Toronto, and I took her to the Art Gallery of Ontario and to the Kleinberg. Kleinberg is really great. It's north of Toronto, and it's a bunch of old pioneer buildings where there's a huge collection of the Group of Seven. And so here's this New Yorker with an MA in art who said she learned more about Ming vases than she ever wanted to know and said, oh, my God, I never knew any of this existed. And Elizabeth sort of said the same to me. There's a film that just came out called The Painted Land, and it's about people who live in northern Ontario who look for the places that the Group of Seven painted. And it's kind of a fun film. And I've been trying to get money to do a film on Emily Carr that's not about her personality but her work. Take her seriously as an artist. And I've actually written a treatment. And so at the film festival, they showed Painted Land, and the producer-director were there. And I walked up and I said, I want to make a film on Emily Carr. So we're talking. Hey? But I think it's really important to see her not as a weird woman, but as an artist. But then AGO has lots and lots of the Art Gallery in Ontario, lots of Group of Seven. And I considered doing a book on Loren, but I've got too many other projects in the fire, and somebody else is doing it on him. He's a wonderful person, Loren Harris. Do you know Massey Harris? They made threshers and all kinds of farm equipment. He's from that family, Massey Harris, and so he was one of those rich boys, and that he basically funded this Group of Seven. And there's in Toronto, there's a small house studio house he built for seven people, and it's still sitting there, and people still work in it as artists. But they're very, very important. And when they first started showing their stuff, they had the same reaction that Emily Carr had in the West. And people thought it was disgusting and terrible. And now the Group of Seven is an icon. It's in all the government offices. People get bored with it. But it's really quite beautiful stuff. And they're quite different, the different Group of Seven people. But Kevin's asked me to tell you a little bit about tomorrow. Tomorrow we're going to look at the totem images. We're going to spend a little bit more time on looking exactly at First Nation art, the things that inspired Emily Carr. And then we're going to look a bit at mythological thinking. I have this thing where I juxtaposition mythological thinking with scientific thinking so that we can understand the mindset of people who make this art. And that's what tomorrow is about. And so, first of all, we're going to look at Pacific Northwest totems, the stages and types. Then we're going to look at cognition, or what happens in our brain. Psychological cognition, directive scientific cognition, and archaic original mythological cognition. And then we're going to look at the mythology or the cosmology of the Kakakokwa. And it's very important if you understand how they see the world organized and the role that the art played in that world. Now, Emily Carr didn't have the advantage that we have today of the studies of the anthropological studies. So she was working from a more direct artistic perception, but we now have all this enormous ethnography so that we can really look at their pictures in a different way. So we're going to do this little bit of a talk in the morning. You can probably tell I'm an old academic and I try to do too much, but give you too much. And then we're going to go to the museum in the afternoon, and Dossiant is going to show us around to give form and understanding to the talk. Okay? So, questions about Emily Carr? Yes?
I've read most of the books, but it's been quite a while.
Yeah?
Is there a story about the Group of Seven not accepting her, though?
Oh, no. Loren Harris just opened his arms and said, "You're one of us." And it's the first time anybody had ever really accepted her.
But she was never part of them.
Well, the Group of Seven was a group of seven men,
yes,
who were, and they later expanded it to be called the Canadian Group of Painters. But people still call them the Group of Seven because it's such a nice sort of little, you know, it's got zip to it. But she was, they were mostly in Ontario and Quebec. And she actually died before they really got going. Yeah. But they really embraced her. And Loren Harris was one of her best friends. He's very interesting because, reason why I'd like to do, thinking of doing a book on him, because his work was so dynamic, and then he and his best friend traded wives. Emily Carr was really upset about that because she liked all poor people. And Husser was a writer, an art writer, a critic, and he actually helped her with her writing, encouraged her writing. And so she felt a little bit distant. And you can imagine when people do musical wives. And it was totally unacceptable at the time. And
yeah,
so Loren Harris and his new wife, Bess, who was the same wife, name, which is, moved to the U.S. And they lived in Connecticut for a period of time. But then they went and lived in New Mexico. And when the Second World War started, Canadians could not send their money out of the country. And so they came back to Canada, but they came to Vancouver. So they lived just a couple kilometers away from where I live right now. But his art totally changed when he left the land with his birth.
It tried wise permanently?
Exactement. So Emily covers a little bit.
How does our change?
His art became very, very abstract. And he encouraged Emily to do abstract art, and she struggled with that a lot. And she said, I can't do abstract art. You know, to me, it's got to be embodied in nature. But it was always a very positive relationship. In fact, he was one of her executors of her estate, and they were very, very close, especially when he lived in Vancouver and she was in Victoria. They had a much closer connection. And she sort of got over her, you know, stuff around his life.
So how old was she, was Emily, when her parents died? You said her sister
she was 15 when her mom died.
Oh, 15.
And she was 17 when her dad died.
Oh, okay.
And I argue that it's really unfortunate for a kid to lose their family or parents at that age, but it gave her the freedom to become an artist. She would have been held down quite a bit. And then when her brother died, when he was 22, it meant that the fortune, car fortune, went to the girls.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Because if he had left, he would have gotten a fortune, right? And I'm also arguing, people say that she was all uptight sexually, and they have all these perverse kind of arguments, but I argue that there's six major reasons why she decided not to marry, and one is that she was not a person under the law, and if she married, her small inheritance would all go to the guy, and I don't think she really, even though you really love somebody, you can't, she wasn't going to give up her art,
no.
Because it would then belong to him. It's one of the six reasons why I argue she didn't marry.
Some of the others.
Well, you're going to read my book. Push for the book, eh? Are there other questions?
Mm-hmm. I have a bit. Well, I hope you won't take it as an
interpretive
question.
Oh, I'm an old professor. Say what you want.
So, what have you figured out about why you left the voiceover?
Why did you what?
What have you figured out about why you got the voiceover?
Well, you see, I worked in health and justice for a number of years. Part of it was evidentiary medicine. We were trying to figure out what medical people had to collect in order to get for evidence, to get some kind of justice for people that were abused. I also worked on the Canadian Commission on Sexual Offences Against Children and use of children in pornography and teen prostitution. And I was responsible for the incest files for the country. And I was really quite what I call vicariously traumatized by documenting all of this horrific violence against women and children. That's why I went into analysis. And while I was in analysis, I had these dreams that I was in Zurich. I was doing a Martha and Mary with Jung. I was sitting at his feet like Mary. I was setting up the room like Martha, as we did earlier today. I was his teaching assistant, basically. And my analyst said, you have to pay attention to this. This is a compensation. This is what's missing in your life. And she said, well, just fly over and take a look. It's not that hard. So I thought, well, I'm not the kind of person, I don't really like to be a tourist. I like to go there and be there. And so I decided to do a semester. And it was while I was there. Yes, and when I got there, and I went in, this was the old institute that I started in, but I ended up at ISAP because 90% of the inhabitants went to ISAP. I got there. I was shocked to find out that the room in my dreams was the room in Zurich. And I'd never seen it.
Wow.
It's dreams are just amazing to me. So I was a little bit freaked out by that. But it was when I was there, I had this voice from in the dream and said, do your thesis on Emily Carr. And I thought, how presumptuous. I don't need a second doctorate. I got enough degrees. I got a job. I got a life. Like, what's this all about? So, as a matter of fact, it took me 10 years to do my training because I was trying to juggle it with all other kinds of stuff. But for the first while, I just wasn't sure that I was going to do it. And so in the first semester, for the psyche to come forward, I think I was sort of like to my psyche saying, do you please on Emily Carr? Because it's presumptuous, I thought. You know? But I'm really glad that I did, because it brought me into the migration complex. So I understand a lot more about my own psychology, being the second generation. And I understand more about the Canadian psyche, because we're closer to the migration than you guys are. Like, we're lots of first generation, lots of second generation, a few third generation. So that was really important to me. But my parents are musical and artistic. My father, in his third career, was a land developer for a while, but he was a stained glass artist, did lots of church windows, and a sculptor. And my mother, he plays the violin, and is a tenor. And my mother is a pianist and an organist, and she's a watercolorist. And so I grew up in a very artistic family. And when I started out my career as a nurse, I was a registered nurse working open heart surgery intensive care, and I found I was vicariously traumatized. So much of some of the research I've done in family medicine, where my academic appointment is on vicarious traumatization of healthcare workers. But I was traumatized by working open heart surgery intensive care, and so I balanced it by doing fine art courses. And I considered being a medical artist. And so that was where I was going to. That was what was happening. So doing my thesis on Emily Carr led me back into the art world. Because I was married, my husband was doing his doctorate in moral philosophy at Oxford, so I stopped doing that. And when I was living in Oxford, it's a very heady place, and I realized I was basically uneducated. So when I came back, I did a BA, an MA, and PhD. But the thing is, I opened my mind to more things than just doing art. So me doing a thesis on Emily Carr meant that I could do this full circle. And I had dreams where there was this rainbow from me into the artist's self.
Wow.
It was so the psyche was really trying to help me heal by showing me about the migration complex, you know, integrating my artist self and my current self. So that's voiceovers are pretty important. Unless they're saying things like, you know, crying or something like that. Okay. I always think that personal experience is sometimes a better illustrator than theoretical stuff. Yeah?
I don't know anything about the Freudian interpretations that your lecture is giving picture of. What how did it come to be that there's been another Freudian analysis of Emily Carr? Is it simply from her paintings? Or how did that work, and how is it being...
Well, what happened is that there's an art historian who did the first comprehensive biography, and she's done a great work collecting a lot of facts and stuff, but she's not a psychologist. And and Emily Carr is a weird woman for her time. Nowadays, she'd be like all of us, hey? Although she didn't wear trousers. She wore dresses. But she's pretty short. So she was ahead of her time, and so she was considered quite weird. And I think that her primary biographer, who won a Governor General's Award for that book, just didn't know where to turn. And Freudian perspective was the primary... She published in 77. It was still the primary perspective. Like, when I went through nursing, we were taught Freudian stuff. Mm-hmm. And I thought, can't relate to that as a woman. And so it's really disingenuous, I think, I'm interested if she will email me or contact me after my birth. I don't think she will.
Well,
she's still alive. She just recently retired.
Why don't you mail her a copy of your book when it comes out?
She's got to buy it.
Okay.
I love it. Sorry, I'm the Reverend. but I couldn't accept that. And so this is one of the reasons why I hesitated. I thought, I don't want to be connected with this crazy old bitch. Who's all sexually thwarted and all that kind of stuff. But the reality is that when you have one biographer who becomes the voice, then subsequent biographers just copy it. And there was Susan Cream wrote a book recently. She calls it not a biography. She calls it, she has some funny words for it. But I really liked her book. But then she agrees with this early biographer saying that Emily Carr was pretty fucked up. And I emailed her and I said, I loved your book, but why did you take so-and-so's perception of her, this Freudian analysis? And she wrote back and said, well, that was a long time ago I wrote my book. And I said, but still, please tell me why. And she said, the majority of the biographer's perspective on Emily Carr is based on Hembroff. Hembroff was a young art student who lived in Victoria and wrote two books about her, although some curators say they're not really books. And she's one of those people that I say, with a good friend like that, I mean, who needs enemies? She's all sort of effusive about Emily Carr, and then she twists it and turns her in really kind of negative ways. And so they're looking at all this negative stuff because she knew her personally, right? But they're not looking at Hembroff to see why she qualified to say what she said and who was she. And she was an unsuccessful artist.
Well, were any of them looking at the paintings?
I mean, I don't get the picture of Emily Carr that you're describing. They describe from the painting.
I don't either.
Yeah, that's
I don't either. And so I read her work and I looked at her paintings and I said, they're off base. Let's look at this in new eyes.
So why call her weird?
Well, that was my perception when I had this voiceover that I thought, well, I don't know if I want to do something on this artist who's weird.
Right?
Well, if you read the biography, you would think first.
Well, but maybe she's an individual, or maybe other people are weird. You know what I mean?
The general feeling until recently is that she was, well, messed up.
Well, for her time, she was totally weird.
Yes, she was.
She was a very bizarre woman.
She was before her time. Yeah. I'm not saying she's weird. I think she's quite wonderful.
But the view was that she was messed up in the sense of psychologically disturbed.
Yes, that's what these biographers say. And because they've got Freudian models, she's sexually disturbed. And there's no evidence for that at all. Okay? So I argue that if you take a Freudian analysis, you've got to find the baby to fit the facts.
Talk a little bit about an event that you described, or briefly described, that would have led to her really realizing her spirit and her being.
She talks about them herself. If you read her journal, Hundreds and Thousands, she talks about them. Yeah. She just, the woods just open up for her. And she had this method of where she would go sit in the woods and she'd sit there and just meditate, and she'd smoke a cigarette to get rid of those mosquitoes. And she'd just sit there until something spoke to her. And when something spoke to her, she would start singing. So she'd been brought up in this religious tradition, and she knew all these hymns. So she would start singing these hymns of joy and paint. So much of her stuff looks ecstatic because she was feeling that way. Yeah.
So I have a little bit of a personal question for you. Have I permission not to answer?
What's that?
Have I permission not to answer?
Yes, you can.
Yeah. What is it?
So, when you say that you began your healing journey,
yes.
What was it specifically, firstly, for you that led you to Jungian psychology?
I'll tell you, this friend that has an MA in art in New York, her brother and I were extremely close friends. And he was teaching at Memorial University in St. John's, Newfoundland. His geographer. It's a great place. It's unusual. It's the product of the clashing of the North American and the European plates. So there's all this debris from the crash of the two plates, right? The two continents. In fact, it's one of two places in the world where the mantle sits above the crust. So you're driving along and you see these orange hills. That's the mantle of the earth. And there are all these volcanic pillows, and it's petrified volcanic pillows. So he's in Newfoundland, and he's a geographer, and he's going on sabbatical. And April said, he couldn't figure out where to go on sabbatical. And I said, have you thought about astrocartography? And I don't know if you know what astrocartography is, but it's where you take your astrological signs and you have it mapped onto the world, and it tells you where the best places in the world are for you to live.
Sure.
So he said, okay, he's amusing and he hates trying. So he found out that Brussels was actually the very best place in the world for him to do a sabbatical. So he contacted people in Brussels and he went there to do a sabbatical. And his sister said, when you're in Brussels, you've got to do analysis. They have a bit of a difficult family background. And she's also an analyst in New York with an MA in art. But so he went there and he comes back and we're camping in the mountains and he said, this is your thing. So we wrote down our dreams, went hiking, came back, did the campfire bit, and then we talked about our dreams. And it was the very first dream that I worked on that I realized that this was powerful stuff. And in that dream, I'm walking down some cobblestone roads, and I'm like a district nurse. I'm going in and helping these people, and helping those people, and helping those people, and helping those people. And as the sun is going down and it's getting darker, I'm walking up this hill till I get to this house on the edge of the hill, up three floors. And you know, three floors means that it's a repeated action thing. And I get up to the third floor, and I'm too tired to make my own dinner. And it was so clear to me, because I was brought up as one of these dutiful daughters, that I was giving all my energy to everybody else, so I had none for myself. It was just crystal clear to me. Mm-hmm. And I thought, this is amazing. I have to understand this enormous source of knowledge that's just sitting there and untapped. So I went into analysis. Does that answer?
Yeah.
Any other questions? I guess we can call it an evening.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.